Progressive Radio Network. We're moving forward, and we hope you're coming with us.
It's the VRONX. You know what's next.
It's a bowl of soul. Sweetest song. And get your dose of classic soul and independent R&B music from the United States and abroad on Friday at 6 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. A Bowl of Soul is a music experience you won't forget or regret. Check out A Bowl of Soul on the Progressive Radio Network.
PRN.FM, your station for progressive viewpoints on politics, economics, health, the environment, and a whole lot more. The Progressive Radio Network is moving forward, and we hope you're coming with us.
Stop Shuffle. This is Lead Story. I'm Eutrice Lead. It's Friday, February the 15th, and as you know, the Senate Republicans have blocked the vote on Hagel's nomination. Just one day shot, one vote shy of the 60 that the Democrats needed to greenlight the appointment of Chuck Hagel as Secretary of Defense, Senate Republicans made good on their threat to block his confirmation. It was a stunning rebuke to their former colleague and his sponsor, the president, and it set a precedent as the first time ever that a nomination for a cabinet-level position was filibustered. Republicans on the Senate Armed Services Committee said Hagel has not complied with their repeated requests for information on paid foreign policy speeches he has made, and his work in private investment groups. And although not directly linked to Hagel's confirmation, they also are stalling his confirmation because, they said, they have not received full details of the terrorist attack on the U.S. consulate in Benghazi, Libya, last September 11th. No information, no confirmation, was Lindsey Graham's mantra. Lindsey Graham, the senator from South Carolina, is one of the leaders of the PAC. Here's an infuriated Harry Reid, Senate Majority Leader, reacting to the filibuster after the deed was done.
In less than 2 hours, our country will be without a Secretary of Defense. At a time when we have a war going on in Afghanistan, we have about 70,000 troops there, we have a nuclear weapon was detonated in North Korea a few days ago. They're threatening, as they have publicly on other occasions, but after this bomb was set off, that they were doing it to attack us. We have the situation in Iran with all their very, very militaristic statements against us. All over the world, America is involved in matters dealing with our military. The filibuster of Senator Hagel's confirmation is unprecedented. I repeat, not a single nominee for Secretary of Defense ever in the history of our country has been filibustered. Never, ever.
The Democrats won't be able to do anything about Hagel's nomination for at least the week that Congress is out. At her first hearing, U.S. Senator Elizabeth Warren was on the other side of the witness table for a change. She was on the dais of the Banking Committee questioning seven senior-level federal regulators about their oversight of Wall Street and the nation's financial institutions. The hearing was the committee's semi-annual meeting on the Dodd-Frank Financial Reform Act, implemented in 2010 as a response to the financial crisis. The legislation tightened laws regulating big banks and provided safeguards intended to shield consumers from abusive financial practices. Here's Senator Warren questioning the regulators about an issue we've discussed here several times on Lead Stories.
Nevada was particularly impacted there. I think for the surviving banks, one, it's a tribute to the work they did to manage their way through this, and I think it's fair to say they're deserving of particular attention and support going forward, because there is a particular role that community banks play in terms of credit availability. That was the point I made earlier. That's important because the particular niche for small banks is, as you know, is small business lending, which tends to be labor intensive and highly customized. It's the sort of lending that the large institutions who are interested in standardized products that they can offer in volume aren't necessarily interested in providing. So the community banks really have a critical role in filling that niche in the financial system.
Yeah. Looks like you have a comment, Mr. Curry.
Yes. I've been a community bank supervisor at the state and federal level for over 25 years, and I saw firsthand in New England the importance of community banks and their ability to help dig out of a severe recession. So I share your concerns and also your commitment to community banks. I think as supervisors, we can play a role in whether it's rule making or in the manner in which we actually supervise and examine these banks eliminate unnecessary burden. It's something that we're committed to doing at the OCC, where we have over 1,600 institutions. And the supervisory process, I think, for smaller banks is when the examiners talk to CEOs and lending officers, there's actually an ability to share best practices and help improve the performance of community banks.
Thank you. And Mr. Chairman, thank you very much.
Senator Warden.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman. Thank you, Ranking Member. It's good to be here. And thank you all for appearing. I sat where you sat. It's harder than it looks, so I appreciate your being here. I want to ask a question about supervising big banks when they break the law, including the mortgage foreclosures, but others as well. You know, we all understand why settlements are important, that trials are expensive, and we can't dedicate huge resources to them. But we also understand that if a party is unwilling to go to trial, either because they're too timid or because they lack resources, that the consequence is they have a lot less leverage in all the settlements that occur. Now, I know there have been some landmark settlements, but we face some very special issues with big financial institutions. If they can break the law and drag in billions in profits, and then turn around and settle, paying out of those profits, they don't have much incentive to follow the law. It's also the case that every time there's a settlement and not a trial, it means that we didn't have those days and days and days of testimony about what those financial institutions had been up to. So the question I really want to ask is about how tough you are, about how much leverage you really have in these settlements. And what I'd like to know is, tell me a little bit about the last few times you've taken the biggest financial institutions on Wall Street all the way to a trial. Anybody? Chairman Curry?
To offer my perspective.
Sure.
As a bank supervisor, we primarily view the tools that we have as mechanisms for correcting deficiencies. So the primary motive for our enforcement actions is really to identify the problem, and then demand a solution to it on an ongoing basis.
That's right. And then you set a price for that. I'm sorry to interrupt, but I just want to move this along. That's effectively a settlement. And what I'm asking is, when did you last take, and I know you haven't been there forever, so I'm really asking about the OCC, a large financial institution, a Wall Street bank, to trial?
The institutions I supervise, national banks and federal thrifts, we've actually had a fair number of consent orders. We do not have to bring people to a trial or an
Well, I appreciate that you say you don't have to bring them to trial. My question is, when did you bring them to trial?
We have not had to do it as a practical matter to achieve our supervisory goals.
Ms. Walter?
Thank you, Senator. As you know, among our remedies are penalties, but the penalties we can get are limited, and we actually have asked for additional authority, my predecessor did, to raise penalties. When we look at these issues, and we truly believe that we have a very vigorous enforcement program, we look at the distinction between what we could get if we go to trial and what we could get if we don't.
I appreciate that. That's what everybody does. And so the question I'm really asking is, can you identify when you last took the Wall Street banks to trial?
I will have to get back to you with the specific information, but we do litigate, and we do have settlements that are either rejected by the commission or not put forward for.
Okay, we've got multiple people here. Anyone else want to tell me about the last time you took a Wall Street bank to trial? You know, I just want to note on this. There are district attorneys and U.S. attorneys who are out there every day squeezing ordinary citizens on sometimes very thin grounds and taking them to trial in order to make an example, as they put it. I'm really concerned that too big to fail has become too big for trial. That just seems wrong to me.
If too big to fail, she says, has become too big for trial. Interesting. Interesting. Interesting also that the chairman, she's so new to the process, the chairman of the committee called her Ms. Warden as opposed to Ms. Warren. Well, ABC News is reporting that the White House, in a bid to clear the way for a vote on Chuck Hagel's delayed nomination to be Defense Secretary, has turned over some more information on the president's activities during the 24 hours that the attack was occurring on the U.S. consulate in Benghazi. Among other things, this information, which came in the form of a letter, says that the president had intensive involvement in the matter, and yet we are hearing some other things that the president was apparently not in contact. The information on the president's involvement was addressed to Senators McCain and Senator Ayotte and Senator Graham. They all demanded the information. As you know, I just said, part of this whole debacle over the confirmation of Hagel. I'm so sorry. I have to sneeze. I'm just having the equivalent of Marco Rubio's water break. But they are onto something, and I want to course you through this very carefully because, in my view, what is happening here with a demand for information about Benghazi, although it is unrelated to Hagel's appointment, it is really unrelated to it in a way, but what they are trying to do, in my view, is make the case, the eventual case, for an action against the president in the form of impeachment. What they're clearly proving or attempting to prove is that at a time when he should have been functioning in his capacity as commander-in-chief, the president was unavailable to be consulted by the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, by Leon Panetta, and possibly even by Hillary Clinton. We don't know. So let us revisit some of the questioning, particularly by Lindsey Graham, of Leon Panetta, and by Senator Kelly Ayotte of New Hampshire, of Leon Panetta. We'll start with that one. Senator Kelly Ayotte questions Leon Panetta about the whereabouts of President Obama on the night of the attack. Here's Senator Ayotte.
So he didn't ask you what ability we had in the area and what we could do?
No, I think, I mean, he relied on both myself, his secretary, and on General Dempsey's capabilities. He knows generally what we've deployed into the region. We've presented that to him in other briefings, so he knew generally what was deployed out there. But as to specifics about time, et cetera, no, he just left that up to us.
Did you have any further communications with him that night?
No.
Did you have any other further communications? Did he ever call you that night to say, how are things going? What's going on? Where's the consulate?
No, but we were aware that as we were getting information on what was taking place there, particularly when we got information that the ambassador, his life had been lost, we were aware that that information went to the White House.
Did you communicate with anyone else at the White House that night?
No.
No one else called you to say, how are things going?
No.
Okay. And since then, has the president asked you, why weren't we able to get, in light of the second attack that occurred 7 hours later, armed assets there in order to help those who were left and attacked in the annex?
The president has made very clear to both myself and General Dempsey that with regards to future threats, we have got to be able to deploy forces in a position where we can more rapidly respond.
But just to be clear, that night he didn't ask you what assets we had available and how quickly they could respond and what we could do to help those individuals there.
I think the biggest problem that night, Senator, was that nobody knew really what was going on there.
And there was no follow-up during the night, at least from the White House directly?
No, there wasn't.
I would, if I could just...
Well, then comes Senator Lindsey Graham of South Carolina, who has been just angry about the fact that he says the American people have not received full information about the attack on Benghazi, and they've been encountering a certain amount of resistance from the White House, from the Secretary of State, from the Department of Defense, etc. So Lindsey Graham comes now and hammers Panetta and General Martin Dempsey, who is the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, wanting to know more specifics about who was in touch with the president and how often, and what was the knowledge available about this attack, which lasted almost 8 hours. Here's Senator Lindsey Graham.
Your testimony, as I understand it, Secretary Panetta, that you talked to the President of the United States one time.
Talked to him on September 11th with regards to the fact that we were aware this attack was taking place.
One time?
Right.
What time did you tell him that?
I think that was approximately about 5.
Yeah, about 5.
About 5 o'clock.
General Dempsey, did you ever talk to the President of the United States at all?
I was with the Secretary at that same time.
Did you talk to the president?
Yes.
You talked to him how many times?
The same one time.
How long did the conversation last?
We were there in the office for probably 30 minutes.
So you talked to him for 30 minutes, one time, and you never talked to him again? Neither one of you?
Until afterwards.
Until after the attack was over.
That's right.
Thank you. Were there any AC-130 gunships within 1,000 miles of Benghazi, Libya?
No, sir.
Were there any AC-130 gunships within 2,000 miles of Benghazi, Libya?
I have to go back and look at a map and figure out the distance. The nearest ones I were aware of were
You said the F-16 was not a good platform to defend the consulate. What would have been the appropriate platform?
The appropriate platform, Senator, would have been to have boots on the ground ahead of the event. After the event is in conduct, it would be very difficult to have a
Would an AC-130 have been a good platform to help defend the consulate after the attack?
If we had the adequate understanding of what was on the ground so that we weren't killing an...
Is there a saying in the military, when you go into harm's way, we got your back?
Of course, yes, sir.
Don't you think that saying has been undermined here, that how can people in the military, the Foreign Service, believe we got their back when after over seven... One, did you know how long the attack was going to last, Secretary Panetta?
No idea.
Well, it could have lasted for 2 days. Now, my question is, was one airplane anywhere in the world deployed in the aid of the consulate? Did anybody launch an airplane? Was any airplane launched anywhere in the world to help these people?
Well, we ultimately did launch 130s to go in and rescue the people.
When were they launched?
They were launched in the period of time when the team went in there, and when we concluded, the attack was concluded, we said we've got to get the people out of there, and that's
was
when we...
Was any airplane launched anywhere in the world before the attack was concluded?
If you're talking about a strike aircraft, no, Senator.
Okay. Was any soldier en route to help these people before the attack was concluded?
Well, we had deployed these FAST teams, and they were on orders to move.
Was anybody in motion before the attack concluded to help these people? Anybody?
Only the personnel that were in Tripoli.
Okay. Was any DOD asset ever deployed to help these people before the end of the attack?
Was any
DOD asset, aircraft or individual soldier, ever sent, put in motion to help these people before the attack was over?
If I could, as soon as we knew there was an attack, the National Mission Force and the FAST teams began preparing.
My question is, did anybody leave any base anywhere to go to the aid of the people under attack in Benghazi, Libya, before the attack ended?
No, because the attack ended before they could get off the ground.
Okay, and we didn't know how long it would last. Now, back to the threat assessment. In these 281 threats that we've received, can you go back and look and see if any of these threats have a cable from a U.S. ambassador saying, if we're attacked, the consulate is attacked in a coordinated fashion, we cannot defend the consulate, and oh, by the way, there are Al-Qaeda flags flying over government buildings? Is there any other situation of these 281 that rise to that level? Because I want to know about if there is.
The State Department would have the answer to that question.
Okay, let's talk about the State Department. General Dempsey, seems to me that General Hamm kept you pretty well informed.
I agree with that.
I agree with that, too. And I want, did General Hamm on that night, ever suggest that a military asset, did he order a military asset in motion and someone told him to stand down?
No. In fact, he was with us in the Pentagon that
day. Okay, so he was with you. Now, you knew about the cable from Ambassador Stevens because General Hamm informed you of it. Is that correct, General Dempsey?
In a written weekly report.
Okay. So when Secretary Clinton testified a few weeks ago that she had a clear-eyed assessment of the threat we faced in Libya, is that really a credible statement if she didn't know about the ambassador's cable on August the 15th saying we can't defend this place?
Well, I don't know that she didn't know about the cable.
She said she didn't.
Then that's a...
Are you stunned that she didn't?
I would call myself surprised that she didn't.
Okay. Are you surprised that the President of the United States never called you, Secretary Panetta, and say, how's it going?
You know, normally in these situations...
Did he know the level of threat?
Let me finish the answer. We were deploying the forces. He knew we were deploying the forces. He was being kept...
I hate to interrupt you, but I got limited time. We didn't deploy any forces.
No,
Did you call him back? Wait a minute.
The event was over.
Ms. Secretary, you didn't know how long the attack would last. Did you ever call him and say, Mr. President, it looks like we don't have anything to get there anytime soon?
The event was over before
it lasted almost 8 hours. And my question to you is, during that 8 hour period, did the president show any curiosity about how's this going? What kind of assets do you have helping these people? Did he ever make that phone call?
Look, there is no question in my mind that the president of the United States was concerned about American lives.
Well, all due respect, and, frankly, I don't believe that's a credible statement if he never called and asked you, are we helping these people? What's happening to them?
As a former
chief of staff
to the president of the United States, the purpose of staff is to be able to get that kind of information, and those staff were working with us.
So you think it's a typical response of the president of the United States to make one phone call, do what you can, and never call you back again and ask you, how's it going, by the way? Showing frustration, we don't have any assets in there to help these people for over 7 hours?
The president is well informed about what is going on.
Well, you can sense here where they're going. And again, I just want to repeat so that people, the pieces kind of fit into something and it's forming. The question, obviously, beforehand was, well, why would the Republicans insist on linking something that doesn't really apply to the appointment of the Secretary of Defense? He had nothing to do with it. I mean, why would they make this a condition of the appointment, and why would they hold things up about this? Well, it's politics, and in politics, it's a matter of winning. They were not able to win at this point during the scheduled hearings for the Benghazi attack. One of the prime people just was not available. That's Hillary Clinton. And when she became available, it was, a one-day thing. It was about 10 hours worth of questioning from two different panels, but that's what she agreed to do on the House and Senate side. But the members of these committees were not satisfied that they had received enough information. They decided, as a political ploy, that they were going to press the button and link this unlinked thing to the current nomination process. So they were successful in that tactic. And Harry Reid was saying how, wrong it is and how unprecedented it is, and he's very angry. But in fact, it is a political ploy. The Republicans scored a victory here in that they were able to press the button and get information. Of course, it may not have been seemly. It may have, just been an unusual move. But in their minds, the knowledge about what happened in Benghazi far supersedes anything about the, being nice about the situation now. They decided to press the buttons. What did they get out of these pieces of testimony? Suggest to me that they are looking to put together a case for impeachment. They have already gotten from Panetta that he did not communicate with a single person at the White House on that night. They got from Panetta that there was a 5 o'clock briefing with the president, and he and the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff were in this meeting. But what was not said was that it's a regular meeting that they had, a pre-scheduled meeting for 30 minutes. And according to Panetta's recollection during his testimony, they spent about 20 of those 30 minutes talking about the American embassy in Egypt that at that time was being surrounded. And that at that time, the full-scale attack in Benghazi had not yet occurred. So they got that. They got the fact that the president was not in communication after that meeting with either the Secretary of Defense or with the Chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff. So they're going about it in a very, you know, it's a winding road, but I could smell impeachment. That's really what they're after. Because at that time, in that incident, technically, the president should have been wearing his commander-in-chief hat. He was supposed to have known everything going on minute by minute. He was supposed to be conferring with the people in his administration, and they are saying they were not in touch with him, and he was not in touch with them. Not on the day, at the very moment that events were unfolding in Benghazi. It's a very serious thing. So the question is, where was the president? What was he doing? And why did it take, he actually initiated contact the following day? After this 5 o'clock meeting, there was no contact apparently with the president until the following day. So now people may think that this is about a hearing. I think this is about the Republicans getting ready to strengthen their argument that they will proceed at some point with the impeachment of President Obama. And they're not finished gathering facts. They're not finished with this investigation. But this is what it looks like to me. We'll take a break, and when we come back, we'll now discuss black rage and racism, looking at the Christopher Warner story. You're listening to Lee's Stories on BRN.FM. I'm Utrecht Lee, and we're coursing through the day here and just bringing some ideas to you for, you know, thinking it over, pondering some of these things and see where you are going with it. Just as I start out here, I just wanted to mention to you that, you know, some time ago we had a presentation on the invention of the white race. It was a remarkable presentation by Jeffrey Perry, who has actually worked hard and reissued the invention of the white race, updated with even more salient material. There's going to be the beginning of an 8-session class tonight at the Brecht Forum, titled The Origin of Racial Oppression in Anglo-America. If you are interested, it is tonight, starts at 7:30 at the Brecht Forum, which is at 451 West Street in New York City. we know what has happened in this case of Christopher Dorner. And we know that the authorities have officially declared that the body found in that burnt-out cabin was his. And now they're saying, even so, they have no idea of how he died. Whether he died as a result of bullet wounds, whether he died a bullet wound sustained from other officers' guns, or bullet wounds sustained by his own gun. There was a report of one single shot heard after the barrage and the exchange of gunfire between Dorner and the police officers had surrounded his house. Or did he die of some other cause? So the body has been taken to the medical examiner, who will determine a cause of death. It was, of course, a very sad, sad situation. And it brought to mind, to my mind anyway, I talked to you about meeting Colin Ferguson some time ago. And he came to my office to see me, and he was clearly, clearly agitated, very, very, very agitated. And yet very polite, very deferring. And I told you the story about him complaining that he was just, he had had it with racism. He felt that in everything that he did, there was this racist element and that it penalized him. He felt that he was suffering because of it. And the last straw, he told me, was that, in fact, when we were talking, it was about a grade he had received at college that he said just was so wrong. I never did see the term paper, which he promised to bring to me so that I could read it myself and decide, or help him decide whether it was a justified grade or not. He had promised to come back, but I never saw him again until the announcement on the television in 1994, that was, that Colin Ferguson, I didn't know who it was until I saw the picture, and I said, oh my gosh, that's the same person I was talking with. And then this situation with Dorner occurs. And it brought the same thing to my mind that he cites in a long, long manifesto, as they're calling it. I call it a statement. People call it a manifesto. He cited racial discrimination, intense racial discrimination, that in his mind cost him his career. It was about a complaint he had filed against a supervisor. At least this is the way he situated it. A complaint he filed against a supervisor who he said in his statement, he witnessed the supervisor kicking a mentally disturbed person who was a detainee at the time. And although he thought that they were going to proceed with, you know, departmental investigations and hearings and so forth, and he was expecting that something would be done about it, instead he became the target, and eventually he quit the force because they convicted him, or they found him guilty of making false statements against the supervisor. And apparently he was gnawing on this for a long time and in the end became very, very, very ferocious about it and went on the spree. He declared war, a one-man war against the police department. And by the time he himself had died, or was killed, he had taken four lives. It's a very sad story, but I'm pointing to something. When Colin Ferguson committed this act in 1994, two attorneys, William Kunstler and Ron Kuby, who was his junior partner at the time, had advanced a theory predicated on a book by two psychologists, William Henry Greer and Price Cobbs, titled Black Rage. And they tried, or they attempted, to advance the Black Rage defense. And it was greeted generally at the time with a degree of amusement, but they were very serious about this line of defense for their client. And Colin Ferguson, as you know, went on to defend himself, although it was so clear that he shouldn't have, and the judge should have directed that. But he did defend himself, and it was so apparent during the whole course of the trial that he literally was very disturbed. But is there a thing called black rage that could trigger racism so intense that it could trigger somebody to this level of violence? And, or is this a kind of excuse over, you know, how do you extricate, because a guy attacked police officers and people don't like police officers, so, you know, good for him. What is your view about this notion of black rage? You're on the air.
Hi, Therese. Happy Valentine's Day.
Thank you.
You know, I wouldn't necessarily put it so much in the perspective of black rage, just as so much as protecting his nation. The more you learn about something like the what was that precinct down there in L.A. that he talked about? There was a scandal in L.A. that he talked about specifically in his manifesto. I'll remember it as we go along. But the idea that basically there are Nazis and organized crime that have made their way deep into the L.A. police force. And it's not just that they're, you know, a pack of bigots that are having fun doing their bigoted, you know, glory. But these guys have a vested interest in bringing down the nation in order to advance either organized crime or to advance a Nazi cause. And I think that that's much more the situation that would force a guy like this to panic. And I don't really look at it so much as black rage, as just the act of someone who is trying to protect his nation. It's interesting, the security state, if you look at the rise of Homeland Security, for example, Homeland Security, the first guy that George Bush tried to elevate to head of Homeland Security was a guy named Bernie Kerik. And if I understand right, Bernie Kerik is still in prison because of his organized crime ties. And so Bush tried to put one of the organized crime figures in as the head of Homeland Security. Then when he didn't pass muster, he put in Tom Ridge. Now, if you remember...
But you're way off now on the tangent. You need to come close to home.
Well, not really. I mean, basically, I'm looking at the idea that America's security is being put in the hands of the utterly corrupt. And
but this is a situation. This is a police officer. I mean, look at this is an African American police officer, and he defines in his statement he sees the world from that way. He sees the world that way. I want to get one more call before we go, though. Thank you for calling.
Just talking about Tom Ridge.
Let's just do this. The reason is that I want to make sure that I get as many calls as I possibly can, and we are going to continue this on Monday. But hello, you're on the air.
Hello?
Yes, you're on.
Yes. Well, you know, I don't really think it's like that. I think that Domna, he was forced to make a decision, as many other black people have made a decision, to support the status quo and all the stop and frisk and the, you know, patrolling the minority communities more so for drugs and all those other types of inequalities that exist. You know, I think he was more like a Du Bois type of person where he wants to argue in his frame of reference.
Let me ask you, could he have misinterpreted the situation?
That's always possible. But then on the other hand, if you look at 2011, the Human Rights Division had more complaints than ever before in history, and most of them were just swept under the carpet. I think there's no really debate about how minorities are having their rights violated on a daily basis by anyone who comes along. Even your local Burger King can provide enough money to the local political arena to control your local life. So
I got to tell you, I mean, I know many, many, many police officers, African-American police officers, who tell me and have told me things that you wonder how they hold it together on any given day at work.
And they experience many different symptoms. Some of them hate their own kind, and some of them just put up with it until they retire, you know. But Jeffrey Dahmer, he just said that I'm not going to participate in this type of situation since I'm fighting for an equality of all people all the way. There's a lot more to the story. We'll never hear the whole thing about it. And it's a tragedy that he killed these innocent people. But he's no better or no worse than all these other Caucasian policemen who shot down all these other minorities, you know, on the other side of the border, in the apartments, etc. Think he's no better or no worse. It's a symptom of our society, really. This is what we teach ourselves.
Do you see this?
Theory.
I have to ask you, do you see this as a case of just will or mental illness or revenge? How do you see this?
You know, I think that in most of these cases that people don't really may not be discussed much, this is the object of justice. He wanted justice for his case. Just like you go to court, you want justice. And when you take away the ability to go to court against an independent judge and jury, then you've taken away all type of recourse. He wanted justice. Maybe that little kid in Connecticut, God rest his soul, who murdered all those other poor children, God rest his soul, maybe he was looking for justice from his mother who worked there. She also died. So we have to look at our concepts of who justice is, what justice is, and who's it for. And if we could all go someplace for justice, maybe we could decrease these type of inequalities we feel we have no recourse to solve.
Is there any part of him that you, as an African-American man, identify with?
Well, he reminds me of that novel that was in the 1970s. John Greenleaf, I think his name was, wrote a novel called The Spook Who Sat by the Door. Mm-hmm. This parallels that book somewhat, in my opinion, even though the book was they took it out of printing after a couple of runs. But in this situation, both of the character in the book and Jeffrey Dahmer were seeking some sort of justice for the persecution that's been going on all the time. And now people just want to talk about it.
Christopher Dahmer. You mean Christopher Dahmer?
Yes, correct. Yes. Okay. I'm just saying that now it's okay if everyone says that you don't have to obey the laws. If there's freedom of information, we'll give you a blank down sheet of paper, and that satisfies the request. And this type of just in your face, you know, you don't have a better gun than me. I have more calibers on my gun than you. That's the bottom line it comes down to, unfortunately. And we're teaching this as a culture. If we taught peace, we would learn peace. But, you know how that goes.
Thank you so much. Well, we've come to the end of our program today, but we will proceed with this discussion on Monday. I threw it out as some ideas to ponder, to
to get us to situate this thing correctly in our minds, because it is not just a simple matter of, you know, this guy just, you know, broke out one day and killed a bunch of people, any more than any mass killing. There are always these subtexts that we don't know. But this does particularly apply here, in that we're talking about a police officer who, within the ranks of the work that he's working in within these ranks and can't find within himself, cannot find the justice that he desires. We don't know whether, you know, he was making a legitimate claim or not, but it does present a scenario that we need to take a look at, because it gives a window into the world of suffering. A lot of people, racism makes people suffer in ways that you cannot quantify, and then we see it this way in its ugliest form. But it is something to ponder over the weekend until we meet each other again on Monday. And also, take a look at how this situation with the Benghazi attack